Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel, and today we are honored to have Professor Renz Bhatt with us. Dr. Renz Bhatt is a professor of digital humanities and the history of humanities at the University of Amsterdam. He's also the director of the Center for Digital Humanities and the director of the Wyss Center for History of Humanities and Sciences. And today he's here to talk with us about a wonderful book he wrote in 2013 called A New History of the Humanities, The Search for Principles and Patterns from Antiquity to the Present, published by Oxford University Press. Renz, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
It's customary to ask our guests to introduce themselves, talk a little bit about their field of expertise and how they became interested in their area of research, which is humanities in your case. So tell us a little about yourself, please.
Yes, thanks. Well, actually, I started out studying a very different field, astrophysics, in 1983, a long time ago. But at the same time, I also realized I wanted to combine, let's say, the sciences and the humanities. I already had that feeling at high school. So I did secondary subjects in linguistics, which is a humanities field in Western Europe. It's not everywhere the case. I did stuff in art history and also philology. And then after some time, I decided I really wanted to move from the sciences to the humanities for a period. I went to study in Italy, in Rome. And surprisingly, I figured out, hey, there are many beautiful books on the history of science, but very few books on the history of humanities as a general field. And I noted that absence somewhere in the late 80s. I talked about it to several people, very famous people also in the field of history, like Anthony Grafton from Princeton University. But basically, everybody told me such a book cannot be written. And that was actually kind of a wake-up call for me, because I said, but wait a minute, if there are general books on the history of science, why are there no general books on the history of humanities? It's not that we have to be always to dive into, let's say, the original, let's say, sources to write such overview books. So I really needed a kind of overview for myself. And later on, when I went on in academia, I also noted that my students, who I taught basically digital humanities, which is one of my fields here, which actually combines this combined interest in science and humanities, in the field of digital humanities, also the students are basically, you know, entirely, how could I say, flabbergasted by this enormous broad field of humanities. And rather than just focusing on one specific field, literature, I thought we need to introduce them to the humanities in general. And the best way to do this, and I still am convinced about this, is by explaining how these humanities have come about. So providing them with a kind of historical overview of the humanities. And this is actually how I got into this field, which is actually a relatively new field, the history of the humanities.
Yeah. Oh. It makes perfect sense when you said, I didn't know that you studied science. You start with science.
Yes.
And now you're doing digital humanities. So I guess it's it quite makes sense. So can you tell us, well, you did mention how the book came about, because that was my next question. And you're quite right. There are not really a lot of books on the history of humanities. And I myself always thought about it as a very difficult area because it's so broad. We'll get into that a little bit later on.
If you want to write such a book, yes.
You do need, and I do like your pattern, your approach, which is principles and patterns, which I'll ask you now. Actually, can you tell us about the structure of the book? Because I find it quite interesting. You choose several let's say, disciplines, and then you study them in different time periods. So can you, for the benefit of our audience, can you briefly define humanities and talk about the structure of the book, and then we'll delve into more details?
Yes, indeed. It's beautiful questions, because these were also the initial questions I struggled with myself. So how am I going to limit such a book? Should I limit myself to Europe? That was the first question. And I said immediately, no, I want to try, at least to try, to come up with a more global approach. Also because, and I'll explain that later, there have been so many interconnections, so many, let's say, knowledge circulations, that it's impossible to limit oneself to one region. So I wanted to have a global approach. But then what disciplines have to be included? So in other words, what are the humanities? And then you can immediately discover that there are many different definitions of the humanities, even between, let's say, Western Europe or Europe in general and the US, Northern America. For example, I previously mentioned the word linguistics. In most Anglo-Saxon countries, it's seen as a social science, whereas in Europe, it's seen as a humanities discipline. So I said, is there a general definition of the humanities? Actually, there's no good definition. One could say certain disciplines like philology, art history, or part of the humanities everywhere in the world. But these are just, let's say, some of the core literature as well, of course, some of the core disciplines, let's say three that we find everywhere. And then I started out with a well-known definition of the humanities, which was introduced by the German philosopher Wilhelm Dilthey in the late 19th century, who said that the humanities, or translated into English, the humanities are the disciplines that study the expressions of the human mind, or the productions of the human mind. It depends how you define, how you translate the word. But so the humanities are the disciplines that study the expressions of the human mind, like literature, like art. We express ourselves also via language, so linguistics is in there, music, theater. But then that definition also has its limitations, because mathematics is often seen as an expression of the human mind. We don't find mathematics directly in nature, so it's really or invention, although there are controversies on that. But mathematics is not always seen as part of the humanities. There are very, very few places in the world where the mathematical part or the mathematical study is seen as part of the humanities. Basically, it's not. So here we have the main problem. What are the humanities? And I said, I thought by myself, maybe we need a more pragmatic approach by defining the humanities as the disciplines that are studied within the faculties of humanities in the world. And then we find, let's say, more disciplines than just these three that I mentioned previously. We can include, if you want to be inclusive, then we also include history, which in some parts of the world is indeed seen as a social science again, but it's very often seen as part of the humanities in many parts of the world. I included also linguistics. And if you have a broad overview of this history of the humanities from antiquity, so that's important, from antiquity till today, the study of the expressions of the human mind, from antiquity till today, then we certainly have to include the fields like linguistics, historiography, so history writing, philology, musicology, art theory or art history, perhaps also logic, which can be, and perhaps also philosophy, but I'll come back to that later, rhetoric, poetics. Poetics is a kind of forerunner of literary theory. So there may be more disciplines, but these disciplines develop in the course of the later period. So I divided up my book into antiquity, the Middle Ages, which is a bit an old-fashioned and Eurocentric term, so one might nowadays, with hindsight, I might have better called it the post-classical period, perhaps, the early modern era and the modern era. And during those four periods, I investigated how humanities researchers, or how, let's say, in general, scholars investigated this material from, let's say, texts to music, to art, to language. So I also decided to focus on the ongoing, let's say, line, ongoing thread, where scholars have looked for certain patterns, for certain regularities in their data. They wrote grammars, that's well known. The first grammarians or philologists tried to write grammars, not only in ancient Greece, but also in India, even more than in Greece and in China. And they tried to write, treatises about art, which where they also search for patterns. But then I said, at the same time, if my ongoing thread in the history of the humanities is the search for patterns, I also have to carefully look for the attack on patents, where people said, well, patents are useless in the humanities. We have to search for exceptions, for anomalies. So I did these two kind of things. And this was my so-called limitation. One can approach the humanities in many, many ways. But I decided I start with these eight disciplines that I just mentioned. Then I want to describe how they developed into modern disciplines, like film studies, like media studies, which of course did not exist in antiquity. Film is an invention in the late 19th century. And I search for these ongoing line of patterns and therefore also the underlying principles of theories. So that's a long answer to your question, but at least it gives, I hope, for the listeners an idea of what my book is about.
Yeah, and before reading your book, I must say that I'm not from Europe myself, but I was sort of, I guess, because I studied English literature, I was also biased, because when I opened the book and I started reading it, I was pleasantly surprised to see examples from the Islamic world, from Asia, because to me, when I said, okay, the new history of humanities, I said, all right, starts in antiquity, it's very much a European center project, but it wasn't. And as you mentioned, you have kind of broadened the horizon and you expanded this idea of humanities to disciplines that also, you know, disciplines and areas that also had really huge contributions. And we'll get to some of them soon. You mentioned eight fields that you have focused on in this one, and philosophy is left out, but you just mentioned it. So I'm kind of curious to know why you left philosophy out of these eight fields, or is it included in a part of them, maybe?
It's, of course, it's implicitly there, like theology as well, by the way. It's implicitly everywhere. If you look at the index of the book, for example, philosophy is mentioned dozens of times. But the absence of a history of the humanities as a field in general, the absence of that, of such an approach, did not mean that there was an absence of histories of philosophy. There were many histories of philosophy. These have been written for centuries already. What was really missing is these histories of these other disciplines brought together. Now, I fully admit that ideally it would have been lovely also to have philosophy always as a separate chapter in that book. The book would, of course, have been doubled, because we have to remind, we have to remember that philosophy was seen in many parts of the world as a kind of queen of the humanities. It was actually the top, for example, indeed in Europe, but also in the Arab or the Islamic world. One started with the liberal arts, or as they were called in the Islamic world in many places, the studia or the adab disciplines, the studia adabiya, which were basically very similar to the liberal arts. And then after those humanities disciplines, one finally arrived either at philosophy or theology. So there were places in the world, at least the Islamic and the Europe and the, let's say, the Christian world, where philosophy was already left out of the humanities. And also later on, you see that the emancipation of the humanities disciplines meant that they wanted to emancipate themselves from philosophy and from the natural sciences. So there are perhaps reasons where you say, well, philosophy is a somewhat different area, but of course it's impossible to leave it entirely out. But I decided I want to emancipate especially those disciplines that have been, let's say, historiographically forgotten. And certainly philosophy was not forgotten historiographically.
No. Yeah, that's right. And it makes sense because, you know, when people read Plato or Aristotle, their works is also considered poetic. I mean, like Aristotle's poetics, it's literary theory, and you have poetics there. Or theology, the writings of Saint Augustine was considered philosophy, and it's theology. It's still kind of implied in your.
You just mentioned Plato and Aristotle. Of course, the poetical work, so the work on theoretical poetics by Aristotle is in the book, or the ideas of Plato on theater, which were quite negative, by the way, are also mentioned in the book. And there you can see that philosophy actually, in their time, meant also basically everything. that was actually at least the Greek conception. But we should remember, we should also remind that ourselves that also the term philosophy is in itself also somewhat Eurocentric, because it does not exist, for example, in Chinese. There you have notions of bian, which means basically rhetoric, so logical reasoning, you could also say, rhetorical reasoning. But the general term philosophy is also quite, let's say, perhaps not Eurocentric, but certainly Occidentocentric. But coming very briefly, if I may, to the term logic, because logic is included in the original eight disciplines that I start with. And that has also a very specific reason, because it was part almost everywhere as a kind of fundamental study of the arts, of the six liberal arts, seven liberal arts in Europe, the six liberal arts in China, Confucian arts. And logic was always there. It was a kind of fundamental part of human, the expressions of the human mind, as I started my this talk with.
Let's talk about patterns. So you, in the book, you say that you discuss the meta patterns of humanistic disciplines. What do you mean by that? What are these patterns of cyclical shifts that you discuss? And one thing I find interesting is that throughout from antiquity to modern times,
yes,
you talk about descriptive humanities all the way, and then prescriptive, and then becoming descriptive again in modern times. Can you tell us about this?
Yes, I'd love to. So as I said, I search in my historical research, I searched for this ongoing quest for patterns. Although many of these humanities scholars do not use the term pattern themselves, some do, by the way, but they use different terms. They use rules, for example, in grammar rules, regula in Latin, for example, it's very often used. They use terms, indeed, like principles. Aristotle uses it a lot, but also the Chinese Mohist logicians use it. But these are patterns that are searched for by these scholars themselves. I myself, as a, let's say, scholar, I could say meta-scholar that studies these other scholars, can also attribute patterns to this long-term history of the humanities and to distinguish the patterns that I found from the patterns that are found by the scholars, by the actors, the historical actors themselves. I introduced the term meta-pattern. Well, I introduced it, it exists, of course, existed already. But I define that meta-pattern as a pattern that I attributed or that I found. There's a subtle difference here, perhaps, but that I found myself in the material. And one of these meta-patterns that you mentioned just, and which I was very surprised about, is that many of the empirical patterns found by ancient scholars, just take Aristotle's Poetics, were descriptive. So Aristotle, we often think of these rules that Aristotle introduced or found for good Greek plays, where he said it's more important to be, to find plausible narratives than realistic narratives. Things have to be plausible, or every narrative needs to start with a beginning, with a middle where there is the biggest tension, and then the end where there's some kind of catharsis. So he describes basically the Greek plays, the Greek tragedies. These are how the tragedies at that time were made. He's descriptive. But after he created his descriptive rules, others after him, like, for example, the Roman Horace said, we have to, now he becomes prescriptive, we have to follow these rules in order to create good pieces of texts or narratives or even theatre. So the descriptively found rules by Aristotle were immediately, just a few generations later, were applied prescriptively, normatively, by others. And this is a pattern that you see very often, also in the description of art by Pliny, which are then taken up by Vitruvius, for example, in a more prescriptive way. You see it in music. You see it in basically all of the humanities, in linguistics very much. The original grammars were descriptive, many of them at least, and then they are used prescriptively. This is a general tendency, perhaps, of human beings, by the way, that description ends up being prescription. And it takes a long time, centuries often, before, at least in the history of the humanities, it has taken a long time before people realize, wait a minute, we have perhaps become too prescriptively. Maybe we should go back to the original material and see that things also can become descriptively. This was, for example, also discovered by the Italian humanist Alberti. Alberti found out that these very prescriptive Latin rules for, let's say, ancient Latin did not work out, of course, for his contemporary Italian. But Italian as a language, especially the Tuscan language, he was from Florence, the Tuscan language also consisted of many very interesting rules. And he approached this Tuscan dialect, it was not yet a language at this time, not an official language at least, he approached it again descriptively. So he found out that perhaps we should leave that prescriptive, that normative description, so to say, that normative approach behind us and start out descriptive again. So what I found is that there is a cycle, a very long durée, a very long-term cycle from descriptive humanities to prescriptive and then back to descriptive again. That's one of these meta patterns that I found.
And it's interesting because you can only come across this conclusion by analyzing how these separate disciplines have changed over time, which is what you've done in the book. We did mention it at the beginning. I mean, I mentioned it, and you as well, that you have not focused only on Europe. You have not restricted yourself to Europe only, and you have examples from India, from the Islamic world, from Asia. And I'm kind of curious to know, because you see, more recent in humanities, and as I'm sure you're aware, that there is this push or there is this urge to kind of decolonize humanities by focusing on minority writers or minorities or peripheries. Was it a conscious decision or I mean, I'm kind of curious to know why you decided to go beyond Europe.
Well, I already knew this is a very, very, very important question. It was not immediately my aim to join with the, let's say, movement of colonizing the humanities, which perhaps when I started writing the book was not as prominent as it is now. But I did know already a little bit, of course, about the histories of the separate disciplines. So there was, although there was not such a movement as the history of musicology, the history of linguistics was a kind of separate sub-discipline. But as I said, in my book, I wanted to bring all these histories together by see if there were interconnections. And I already knew, for example, that in the history of linguistics, the most prominent figure from antiquity was actually Panini. Panini, as the stress has to be on the first syllable, was an Indian linguist, most probably living in the 5th, maybe in even the 6th century before Common Era. We don't know exactly when he lived. But his grammar, which consisted of almost 4,000 rules, was immensely influential. It was indeed studied by later Persian scholars like Al-Biruni. Al-Biruni in his Indica, or Kitab al-Hind, the book on India, spent a whole chapter on the study of Panini's linguistics. It was translated into, part of it at least, was translated into Arabic. It was lying in some of the libraries in Toledo, in Muslim Spain, the Al-Andalus, from the 10th or 11th century, 11th century onwards. But it only became known in the 18th century in Europe by William Jones, who introduced it during a speech in Europe. And then it became a success story. It was studied by 19th century German linguists like Bob, and they all took elements from it. So they not only got influenced by it, but they said, we also have to create this kind of complex phonological rules that we find in Panini's work. So I was aware of this, what we call circulation of knowledge. And I thought, well, maybe there are more of these kind of circulations of knowledge, also not just from, let's say, India via the Islamic world to Europe, but also, let's say, between China and Africa. Or then I found out that there was an amazing manuscript production in Timbuktu, the great Timbuktu manuscripts of around 500,000, perhaps even more, manuscripts that are still lying there in personal libraries. Are just really amazing. You can find their books on musicology, on logic, on even on the sciences like astronomy, but also lots on history. So there I said, we have at least do an effort to bring them together and see how they influenced or perhaps had a contribution to other humanities fields. Only later on I thought, well, wait a minute, this is also contributing to this notion of decolonizing the humanities, where we try to provincialize Europe as a center of humanities studies. And I think that's very, very useful because indeed the humanities, the study of art, the study of language, of literature, are found really everywhere in the world. So why should we just focus on the West? We should actually try to describe these traditions on their own rights from all parts of the world. But this is extremely complex. So when I told myself this has to be one of my goals, I immediately also contacted people that were actually Indologists, that were Arabists, that were Africanists, and that helped me, I thank them also in my book, by the way, that helped me with finding the relevant literature and often secondary literature, because you have to be sure, if you even consult translations, that these translations are correct. It's not that I myself read and understand all these separate languages, but some people have really done an amazing job by even translating for me some parts that had never been translated before. That was really fantastic.
It was fascinating that you mentioned Panini. You said that we put the stress on the first syllable, right? I didn't know that anyhow. I first came across that name a few years ago. I was a TA in a course in digital humanities, and I read this book. And I think in an earlier communication, I told you that I read this book called Geek Sublime. and there was this computer programmer was talking about Panini and how his book is like a, I don't know, like a blueprint maybe for programming language. And I, out of curiosity, I just picked up the book from the library, the original book. I don't remember what it was called, maybe Panini's Grammar. It's a very small book, 40 pages maybe, because it's in Sanskrit, a series of rules how to, which describes the grammar or how to generate the language. And in that class, I was teaching students. So I decided to pick up the English translation as well. And I read somewhere that it's impossible to translate that unless you explain. You need to have notes upon notes upon notes describing it. So I showed the book to students, 40 pages, small pocket-sized book. And then I picked up the English translation, two big volumes, about 1,000 pages, translation and interpretation of that very, that small book. And I'm you talk about Panini and also an Arabic author, Sibawa, who also had contributions to linguistics. Can you talk about these two figures a little bit more, how they're similar or different? And then later on, we'll talk about philology and how maybe their knowledge of grammar also flows into sciences.
Oh, yeah, wonderful. Sure. Sibawai indeed was a Persian linguist. Most probably Sibawai did not know about Panini's work. So Panini's work is around 500 BCE. Sibawai lived in the 8th century Common Era, let's say in the beginning of the what we call the golden era of Islamic science and humanities, so Islamic knowledge. And in a sense, they are the opposite. So Panini gives a set of a very complex, let's say, almost an algorithmic set of rules. So that's why it's very... it has also been quite influential for computer scientists, because he starts with providing perhaps the first algorithms far before the Arabic al-Gwarizmi, to which the term algorithm has been attributed to. But he starts with a kind of set of rules that are extremely ordered, and if you follow those rules, you can decide for every possible sequence of words or even sounds, possible sequence of sounds in Sanskrit, whether that sequence is a correct grammatical sequence or not. Whereas the later Arabic or Persian linguist Sibawai gives a text, 900 pages, also a very big text, full of the intricacies and, I should actually say, full of the exceptions of the Arabic language. In fact, these two texts, so the first text by Panini is called the Ashtayadi, which means the eight books. That text is meant for young Sanskrit speakers, or at least Sanskrit readers, to learn the exact rules, underlying rules of Sanskrit, but it's not meant for people that want to learn Sanskrit as a second language. The second book by Sibawai, or Sibawai, whatever you want to pronounce his name, is meant actually for learners of the Arabic language that are trained or that have a native language of another language. So, for example, Persian speakers who wanted to read the Quran used this book by Sibawai to go through all the various exceptions or intricacies of the Arabic language. And the interesting thing now is that Sibawai gives one general operator. It's not a rule, a kind of operator, what he calls analogical substitution. And by this notion of analogy, he says you can create new sentences out of all the examples, the examples of the exceptions of the Arabic language. You can create new sentences by combining parts of the examples that I gave in my book. Now, he mentions that very briefly, but he also gives examples where you can substitute just a word from one sentence. If I have two sentences, the man walks on the street, the woman walks on the street, you could also say perhaps, you could also create, let's say the man walks on the street, the woman walks on the road, you could also create the sentence, the man walks on the road, because they appear in a similar context. That's the idea. Now, you sometimes can also create ungrammatical sentences in this way. So Sibawai's text was not as formal, certainly not as Panini's text. So these are different approaches, but interestingly, they also point out to two different traditions in the history of linguistics, one that focuses on regularities and strict rules, and the other one that, Sibawai's one, that focuses more on constructions. And you also have nowadays still a very vivid community in linguistics that is called the construction grammar community, that is actually somewhat opposite to the more Chomskyan, by Noam Chomsky, Chomskyan approach that really focuses on finding the underlying deeper rules.
And it's impossible to talk about the humanities without talking about philology.
Yeah, I agree.
So can you tell us What is philology? How do you define philology? And there's a very important character that you talk about in your book, Lorenzo Valla, if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, Valla. Yep. Can you talk about philology and then tell us who Lorenzo Valla was?
Yeah. Well, if you talk about philology, we should also go back to the establishment of the first library of Alexandria around the 3rd century BCE, where the Alexandrians, as they call it, the Alexandrian philologists, wanted to reconstruct all classical texts from Homer, Herodotus, Hesiod, etc. They wanted to reconstruct all the original texts from the many extant copies, the many copies that they received from these texts. And these copies were often inconsistent, interestingly. We think about Homer as one text, but at the time when this library was created, they collected as many, and they even stole as many possible copies as they could. And then they discovered that hundreds, sometimes thousands of texts were inconsistent, and they thought, how can we reconstruct the original text as it was created by Homer? And they believed that that was possible, indeed. And that goal, that aim, that beautiful goal, was also transmitted to later philologists. It was transmitted during the Middle Ages, and also when we come to the flowering of philology in places like Italy, like with Lorenzo Valla, but also other places in India, but I can come back later to that. And Lorenzo Valla approached texts in a very critical way, similar to these Alexandrians. So Valla was one of the early humanists of the 15th century. He wrote around 1440, 1445. And one of his most famous critical approaches to texts was a critical approach to the so-called Donation of Constantine, Donatio Constantini. He wrote it in Neo-Latin, in Latin. And he also wanted to go back to the original source, and he found out that the so-called Donation of Constantine, which I should say a little bit about before, this Donation of Constantine was also, was always used, at least since almost a millennium already at his time, was always used as a kind of legitimization for the worldly power of the Catholic Church, of the Pope, you could say. And in that document, it was declared that Constantine, that's why it's called the Donation of Constantine, that Constantine the Great, the Roman emperor of the early 4th century, that Constantine, in 313, donated the entire West Roman Empire to the Pope. And the East Roman Empire was then still kept for Constantine himself. So we know that he created Constantinople as his new capital. And this document was used for centuries, as I said, almost a millennium, as the legitimization of the worldly power of the Pope. And then it was actually critically described by Lorenzo Valla, who wanted to go back to the original text, and he found out that the original texts, basically the earliest texts that we had from this document, were all written not in classical Latin, but in medieval Latin. This document could not have been written in the 4th century, in the time of Constantine, but must have been written somewhere in the late 7th or perhaps even in the 8th century. It was full of terms like feudus, that means the feudal system, which simply did not exist in the Roman Empire. It was invented later on, especially in France or late early medieval Italy as well, but especially in France, where you had this system of feudal hierarchies from the king all the way to the to the poor farmers. Now, in this feudal system, if you have words like these, and it was full of kind of these kind of there were words referring to Jews that had nothing to do with the 4th century. Valla said this document must have been a fake. And so he rebutted basically this document, showing that it was entirely impossible to be written in the 4th century Common Era, after which, basically, he wrote a text on it, and it was, this is the most interesting part of the story, it was not immediately put on the so-called Index of the Church, no, it was actually embraced by his, by the Pope, by the then Pope, Pius II, yeah, who was a humanist himself, by the way. His actual name was Innea Piccolomini, and he said, yeah, this document is correct, and then it stopped. He didn't do anything with it. So the Pope maintained his worldly power, and the document was basically, you know, put aside. It was not yet put on the index. This happened 150 years later during the Reformation, but it was taken up the results of that document, where he rebutted, where Lorenzo Valla rebutted this worldly power of the Pope, was taken up by fierce reformers like Martin Luther, but also by Calvin, by showing, wait a minute, here there is proof that the worldly power of the Pope is fake. He should not have worldly power. He should only have, let's say, spiritual power. So it was used as actually a proof that the Catholic Church was corrupted. And here we can have a beautiful example how a discovery in the humanities, a discovery in philology, really, let's say, changed the world. We often forget about this, but certain humanistic discoveries literally have changed the world. And here's an example of it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This is a fascinating example, really, really fascinating. And can you tell us the definition of systematic philology that, and also this is not only something that we use in humanities, like the pattern similar to this also used in modern sciences. Can you give us some examples of that, like genetics, for example?
Yeah, that's true. It takes a long time. But remember that the way, not so much Valla, this has done by later people. So Valla created, or let's say, basically revived this notion of what we nowadays call a critical philology. Humanists, Italian humanists especially, directly after him, like Angelo Poliziano, the name is mentioned also in my book, he also created new rules. One of those rules is called the elimination rule, by which he somehow put the many extant copies, the many surviving or transmitted copies, in a kind of genealogical tree, a stemma. That's what the stemma is, basically, a history tree. And by putting all these possible copies in a history tree, you can show which copies of text depend on other copies. So you put them literally in a kind of history tree of the history of the documents, the history of how these different copies depended on previous copies up to the original text. So the goal is that by putting them into a stemma, you can actually derive the original text. And later philologists, and now I come even back to the 19th century, I even arrived to the 19th century, like Karl Lachmann, a German philologist, he also created a whole set of rules by which you, some of these rules are called the deletion rule, the substitution rule, so by which you can substitute certain words by others so that you can actually show how text got corrupted. But he still used this kind of stemma, a genealogical tree, a history tree. Now, this method became so important that it became known as this as a new field in philology, stematic philology. And it became even taught at high schools, grammar schools especially. It was part and parcel of the curriculum. It is still part and parcel of the curriculum if you study, let's say, classics or other fields in the humanities. But at that time, it was studied even at high school. And interestingly, the earliest geneticists, who at least to whom we attribute the invention of modern genetics, like let's first mention Rosalind Franklin, she's often forgotten, but also Francis and Crick, the two guys who actually got the Nobel Prize for their discovery of the double helix of DNA and RNA structure, they found out that these notions of mutation in genetic strings, is very similar to mutation or corruption, we call it corruption in philology, how texts are transmitted or copied, because if you copy text, you make mistakes. And these mistakes, strangely enough, these copy mistakes that humans make have strong analogies and sometimes are even equivalent when mutations appear in transmitting DNA strings in family. And that's in family, let's say, resemblances, for example, or how even certain illnesses are transmitted. So this discovery that there is a kind of analogy is once again a very beautiful interaction between modern genetics and these modern geneticists like Francis Crick and Franklin, Rosalind Franklin, were trained at grammar schools. They knew about these methodologies and they said, we can basically one-to-one apply these rules of how strings of words get corrupted. But they use, instead of strings of words, they use strings of DNA sequences, or actually strings of nucleotides, maybe the word is. And, this is nowadays well-known in the history of science, but it's nice to emphasize that these methodologies, how you can put all kinds of strings into a history tree, came from stemmatic philology.
So in a way, philology is a way of, let's say, determining the authenticity of sources. And in your book, you talk about Xenodotus and also Zeno of Citium, if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, which have, they have two different ways of, let's say, authenticating the validity of sources. Can you briefly talk about them as well?
Yeah, so Xenodotus is one of the founders of the Alexandrian school of philology. I mentioned the Alexandrians already, right? And their goal was basically to find the original texts from transmitted copies. The school that we often see as in opposition, although the attribution of this opposition came from later Roman philologists like Varro, that school is not so much looking for, let's say, finding the original text, but it's looking more for just taking one text and try to interpret that text in all possible ways, in anthropological ways, geographical, historical ways. And they claimed it's useless to try to find the original text. We never will be able to do that. We should not look for these analogies between texts, but we should look at anomalies, so the exceptions of the singular text. And their school really produced, these are called the anomalists of Pergamon, and they are often opposed to the analogists of Alexandria. They basically were contemporaries, 2nd century BCE, and the anomalist school really produced beautiful texts. There's a text of Kratos of Malos, a text by this Kratos of Malos, who basically wrote 60 chapters, or even he called them 60 books, on just 12 lines of the Iliad. So it really looks like he gives a full set of interpretations why the ships went to Troy and etc. He gives all kinds of perspectives. It really looks like the modern let's say the you could even compare his work almost one to one to beautiful works by Roland Barthes, for example, in the 60s when he analyzes a short story by Balzac in his book. It's a short story, and the book where he analyzes this short story is, let's say, 10 times as big as the original story. So yes, there is also what we can call a kind of anomalist tradition in philology that focuses not so much on this trying to find the original text, but on the interpretation, so the hermeneutic analysis of texts.
And what was the role of philology in creating modernity? You did briefly talk about that. But I'm particularly interested in how it sort of overthrew Aristotle and paved the way for modernity.
Yeah, so it's not only philology, by the way. So here I have to stress that, and I also explain that very carefully in my book, the contribution of early modern philology, art theory, so art history perhaps you could call it, musicology and linguistics, was that they basically brought, already in the early 15th century, a very strong emphasis on empiricism. So an empirical approach to study music, the underlying rules of harmony, for example, a very strong empirical approach on reconstructing the original texts from copies, but also the more empirical approach to describing a linear perspective in art. And you find that, by the way, not only in Europe, but also in China. I have to mention the name of Gu Yangwu. Gu Yangwu is one of the important philologists of the early 17th century, where And he's also one of those philologists that tries to reconstruct, let's say, the original text from copies, and he influences by that also fields like medicine and mechanics in China. But focusing for a moment on modernity then in European philology, there you see that there is at a certain moment a direct interaction between philologists, musicologists, and linguists with the so-called new scientists. So if we take the case of Galileo Galilei, his father was a musicologist, Vincenzo Galilei. They influenced, his father basically gave the empirical approach, the experimental approach, directly to Galileo. We know from Kepler, another example, another icon of the scientific revolution, from Kepler we know that he was also a philologist. He even communicated with the great philologist Scaliger, who was a French-Italian philologist working in at Leiden University, Joseph Justus Scaliger, on philological issues. And Kepler actually used this very empirical approach, also directly applying it to the movement of planets, as we now know. So we see this interaction happening here. And what we then notice, and this is especially important, is that there was this kind of unity between the humanities and the sciences at that time, and they all were opposed to the classical approach let's say, the humanities and the sciences. Especially, this was at that time the most famous philosopher and humanities scholar, you could say, Aristotle. And why they were so much opposed to Aristotle? Because Aristotle was also entirely incorporated by the then Catholic Church. It was a kind of what we would call nowadays a package deal. So the entire world view was based on a kind of geocentric theory of the spheres, and Aristotle was the main towering figure. But if you look carefully at Aristotle, he was not always, in certain fields he was, but he was not always as empirical, as, let's say, descriptive as we believe. So sometimes he was entirely prescriptive if he talked about, not so much about poetics, but when he talked about certain fields, even in biology, but also his ideas about history, sometimes became very, let's say, normative. He started out from principles rather than directly from patterns, if we want to use my terminology here. So yes, it was a kind of rebutting Aristotle. That was the main issue, in Europe at least. But in China, it was, for example, about rebutting Confucius, which was extremely dangerous as well. So if you make this comparison, Guyangwu, it was often that people got, you know, critical about Confucius, who said things that were simply not, you know, valid empirically. And they ran often into the same problems, that they were, let's say, persecuted for being anti-Confucian. And people here in Europe were persecuted because they were anti-Aristotle or anti, indeed, Catholic Church.
Let's talk about another field, historiography. So how did this concept change over time from antiquity to modern? And I know I'm being terribly, terribly broad, because you mentioned several names. You mentioned, let's say, Herodotus and also non-Europeans, people such as Manetho, if I'm pronouncing them correctly again. There is also the oral tradition in China. We have the Islamic historians, towering figures such as Ibn Khaldun or al-Biruni. So maybe broadly you can talk about the field of historiography as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Sorry, I started a little bit reading here, because that is, of course, an immense challenge. How you could just in a few minutes, perhaps, I don't know how
I guess the idea is just to give our listeners a broad idea.
How historiography actually developed as a field. There are many views on that as well. There are many possible perspectives, so to say. If I choose one perspective, maybe I can, by, again, the way how historians have been looking for patterns in history, but this is just one possible way of looking at history, then we can make comparisons, indeed. Huh? We see already, for example, in Herodotus's work, that he found, or that you could also sometimes say that he attributed, a pattern of a rise, peak, and fall of states and empires. So he noticed in his huge description, or let's say history of the Persian Wars, the wars between Persia and Greece, that there was this kind of ongoing line where certain states, you know, start by coming up, they rise in power, then they flourish, and then they decline again. And this seems like a general natural rule, but for him it was something new. And he said this does not only happen with states, but also with persons, right? So you have famous kings like Darius, or like even Alexander the Great, which actually lived after Herodotus. So this is not a good example. He did not use that example, but Darius, he did use, where, you know, you come to a kind of rise, and then he's also... Well, no, Darius also lived, by the way. He's a Hellenistic king. Sorry, this was not a good example either. But he used names I think it was King, the great king, the great, now I'm a little bit flabbergasted here. But anyway, the example is clear. We can find classical examples, and Darius is not the example used by Herodotus, but he used the example of King Midas. That's the name, yes. Where he, at the end of his life, he basically got into trouble. So you see also, not only in states, but also with persons, you see a rise, peak and decline. Now, interestingly, people in other areas, and you mentioned Chinese historiography, and we can mention here Sima Qian as an example, but also Bangu as an example, they described the rises and fall of dynasties, of Chinese dynasty, of, for example, the earliest dynasty, the Qin dynasty, also called as the legalist dynasty, around 200 BCE, but also the Han dynasty, which came immediately after that. So they were looking for rises and fall of dynasties. Now, interestingly, this was really an empirical pattern, because the greatest historian after Sima Qian, who I just mentioned, and indeed who also used oral sources in his big overview of the Chinese history, Bangu, the direct follower of Sima Qian, found an exception. He claimed that in his dynasty, the Western Han dynasty, yes, the Western Han dynasty, there was no decline. The Han dynasty would always flourish. Of course, we nowadays look upon Bangu as a kind of apologetic historian, because he was serving directly the emperor of the Western Han dynasty. So he basically claimed the Han dynasty will live on forever. But interestingly, if we compare these different approaches into history, we also see in Europe, but also in India and other places, that people have also looked for exceptions to these patterns. So again, here we also see both the pattern searching and pattern rejecting. So one person who, for example, in Europe, searched for an exception to the pattern of rise, peak and fall that was first described by Herodotus, as far as we know, was Polybius. And Polybius said, very similar to Bangu, by the way, but they didn't know each other at all, that the Roman Empire would live on forever. He also had an explanation for that, to which I won't go into right now. So he looked for an exception to this pattern. Of course, these historians were wrong. We also know that the Roman Empire declined sooner or later. So in the end, Herodotus' pattern still seems to be valid. And interestingly, you see a recurrent reference to this pattern also in later historians. I can mention Ibn Khaldun, who also describes this wonderful pattern of rise, peak and fall in the 14th century, where he also describes that this is actually a kind of accumulating pattern, because even if a certain empire declines, the new rulers will take up the results of this previous empire, which he describes very nicely for the North African history. And also the history of Al-Andalus, the Spanish Islamic part. Now, it is taken up by later historians like Giambattista Vico, the Neapolitan historian. It is even taken up by 19th century historians, by 20th century like Toynbee, the great British historian. So you find a continuity here in terms of the search for patterns. Now, this very short is a kind of very long durée overview if we look at history from a global perspective. Sorry for my mistake about Darius, and but I recorrected myself. Okay, but this is one way to view it.
You have talked about a lot of, let's say, similarities between humanities and science, and of course we didn't really have anything like science, it was a later invention, and how a lot of contributions of humanities are also used in modern times, even in science. So I'm curious to know about this really this rupture between humanities and science, because there seems to be a culture war, especially in the United States. In more or less capitalist countries, they're constantly defunding humanities because they think that studying humanities won't really lead to a job. So I'm curious to know your thoughts on this dichotomy between science and humanity. Do you see it as constructive, or maybe it brings more harm than good?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's quite almost a kind of open question or open door here, because indeed, I would strongly oppose this somewhat artificial dichotomy. It's also quite recent, the dichotomy. It starts in the 19th century, yeah, with the German distinction between natural science, Naturwissenschaft, and the humanities, Geisteswissenschaft. It has to do with emancipation of the humanities in the 19th century. So until the 19th century, the humanities had an enormous standing, indeed, and they were also continuously, there were cross-fertilizations between humanities and what we nowadays call the sciences. But in the 19th century, the natural sciences, or the study of nature, was definitely making an enormous progress. And especially, and this is the main point, also the humanities made progress in their way of, as I mentioned earlier, the systematic philology of Lachmann made progress, which was later on taken up also by geneticists. But the natural sciences had an immediate impact on technology. And this is something quite unique to the natural sciences, which we find much less in the humanities. So very understandably, humanities in many places in the world were put in a kind of defensive position. So what is their use for technology? And then we find that there were these philosophers, like I mentioned already earlier today, Wilhelm Dilthey, but also we have Wilhelm Windelband. Many of them were German philosophers initially. Rickert, Cassirer. They actually started to create a very strong, particular identity for the humanities. They said the humanities should not look for underlying rules. They should look for interpretations. They should look for understanding historical actors rather than explaining. Explaining is something for the natural sciences. We should deal with it understanding. Now, this strong dichotomy, which was really created by humanities scholars themselves, were quite successful to give the humanities a very specific identity, but they were actually harmful, really harmful, for the reputation of the humanities, because the humanities were actually put in a kind of position that they were dealing with the interpretation of the world, not so much with explaining and changing the world. Now, if we look at actual practice in the humanities in the late 19th and early 20th century, we see a very different thing. We see, as I also stressed in my book, we see approaches to finding, let's say, underlying patterns and principles in literature. Just take Vladimir Prop, but also people like Claude Lévi-Strauss, who analyzes narratives. We see the search for patterns in art, in music, in language, etc. So there is much more a unity with the sciences than people have often claimed. And these claims, coming from philosophy, sadly have been taken over also by politicians that say, well, wait a minute, there is this dichotomy. Why should we still fund the humanities if the main discoveries and also the main applications are made in the sciences? Now, here there is a very big risk. Why? Because there is this continuous interaction between disciplines, also among scientists. Scientists, biologists still take inspiration from formal language theory, for example. And some of them also take, for example, medical scientists or medical biologists take inspiration even from literature. They nowadays have this field of medical humanities, for example. It's very, very important. So to make this distinction too strong is really detrimental for the field of, let's say, knowledge in general. Sadly enough, we don't have a term for this in English, in the English language. We have to say for science and humanities together, right? But in most other languages, we have, let's say in Dutch, we have Wetenschap, in German, we have Wissenschaft. And even in languages like Italian, where you have a very similar word for science, Scienza, it still does include the humanities. But in English, this is kind of, a dichotomy already in terminological, in a terminological sense, where you have to distinguish between science and humanities, because humanities is not included in science. But definitely it is dangerous to make this distinction too strong, because there is this continuous interaction between fields. Yeah.
And I'll ask you a couple of other questions on that. I guess it was about a year ago, I was talking to someone else. It's kind of late at night, I'm forgetting all the names myself. The name of the book was A Humanist Reason.
Eric Hayot.
Eric Hayot, thank you very much. Yes. Yeah. So I was talking, and I really loved the way the book started, because he said that he was in a conference, there was this economist who was talking about, how cultures influence the expansion of technologies. And then he said, well, what you just said, we in humanities have talked about for 200 years. So why is it that what we have created is not really knowledge, but what goes through that scientific method is considered knowledge? So And that's something that humanities is usually accused of. But when reading your book, I see all those patterns. And you talked about, for example, an area person. I mean, you talk about this figure who talk in philology, who works on the principle of elimination. They're very, very similar to scientific methods. So what do you think about this rigorousness of the knowledge that is produced by humanities?
Also, this is a wonderful question on which I could talk for another hour, probably. I'd like to stress that we should neither exaggerate too much the full rigorous method in the humanities. This is one of the methods. At the same time, we also have more, let's say, interpretative methods that start with this so-called hermeneutic cycle, as is well known. The term comes from the 19th century Schleiermacher, the German theologian, you could say, philologist as well, where you try to dive into a certain historical period and look at similarities with your own periods, and then you try to even dive into further and try to also learn the concepts of the period, and finally you get what the late Gadamer called this kind of Verschmelzung der Horizonten, as he called it, the kind of uniting the horizons of your field. But clearly, this is a kind of subjectivist method. It's not that you can really prove, if you try to explain historical actors, you cannot really prove formally, rigorously, that these historical actors were really behaving as you believe that they were behaving. So the point here is you can always go back to the archives, to the original sources, but you can never, the hermeneutic method is not a method that is used, let's say, in a entirely rigorous way. But now comes this big surprise. When I figured out that there is, at least in the humanities, at least two strands, the one of what I call pattern searching, which sounds very rigorous, and the one that I call more the pattern rejecting approach, that is more hermeneutic and interpretative, I also found out that this hermeneutic approach is not entirely inexistent in the sciences. Also, astrophysicists, for example, during the last two decades, have a very fierce discussion on the so-called anthropic principle. So they ask themselves continuously, why are the natural constants, the constant for example, the gravitational constant that is used in the gravitational law of Newton, but also the Planck constant, why are they exactly in such a way that makes life possible on Earth? Now, as soon as even astrophysicists start asking questions like how do we have to interpret these famous natural constants, the constants of nature, they become humanists, they become hermeneutic persons. And at the same time, we also must look at many of the sciences in a way that are viewed as historical sciences. So fields like geology talk about the history of the Earth, but just think about evolutionary theory in biology. Here again, we see that they have embraced as early as the 19th century by Charles Darwin, indeed, in 1859, The Origin of Species, literally embraces also there the notion of a history tree that actually also Darwin himself attributes to an earlier philologist, where you see that there is this, not only this strong interaction between science and humanities here, but again, that there at the same time, next to this hermeneutic approach in the humanities, you also had this very rigorous approach. But what I claim in my book, and I especially mentioned this at the end, is that the humanities is all of it. So what the humanities makes a little bit, I can't say unique, but what makes it really special, that it's not just this very, very objectivist, or one could call very, very rigorous approach, but next to it, you also have this very hermeneutic, subjectivist approach. So the best thing we can do is not so much take this for granted, but really embrace these two approaches as really characteristic of our field. Yeah.
And I'm guessing you're positive also of this new interdisciplinary research where people from humanities or sciences, like example you mentioned, medical humanities or digital humanities. The reason I'm asking is that, again, I was talking to someone, a professor at Melbourne University, who was a little bit critical of cultural studies or film studies because he felt that in literature, the foundation of literature, English literature, is that philological research, and these new, let's say, disciplines are taking a lot of energy from English discipline, at least from the English discipline.
Sure. That's a serious risk. I also remember once a conference, what was it, in Copenhagen, where people said, no, but what humanists really want is to search into manuscripts and to deal with, to work in the archives. But, the humanities are changing also. This is a very somewhat nostalgic view of the humanities. So yes, sure, new fields like cultural studies or digital humanities may take time away or even energy away from the older fields. But we could also say, well, the humanities are growing, they're changing. So new fields like also environmental humanities, for example, this is an upcoming new field. We should not view this as it's quite normal that let's say the older humanists that are still alive view these kind of new fields with some kind of suspicion. But we should also remember that they bring a lot of new energy at the same time. So thanks to fields like digital humanities, I know I'm preaching to the converted perhaps here, but new fields like digital humanities have also raised new questions. Thanks to this field, we can now found out that there are, for example, we found out, for example, a paper trail automatically almost between people like 19th century historians and the 17th century historian Vico, and that before was almost impossible to find out because there were too many search spaces, and now we can do this semi-automatically. So yes, there is this beautiful interaction, but we should be wary of one thing. Often, if we look at interactions between science and humanities, it is said, yes, because the humanities should also try to apply these more empirical methods of the sciences. But then it's often forgotten that these empirical methods were actually first invented in the humanities, in the 15th century humanist tradition, not only in Europe, but also in other regions in the world, where people started to look afresh at art, at music, at language, at texts, and they created the empirical method, which was actually taken over by the natural scientists in the 16th century. So we should actually be proud of our empirical approach in the humanities and fully appropriate it, and also just rightly appropriate it. It is our method, and it has become a general method. Maybe that's also a good statement to almost finish this interview with, I would say. But that's up to you if you want to finish.
Well, yeah, I guess that was my last question. So I guess it's a great note to finish the interview. And I must say that I really, really enjoyed. I did a PhD in English literature, but reading this book really, really changed my perspective about humanities, because I'm always kind of buried into English literature, but knowing about the history of the field is also important. Like any scientist, we should know the history and philosophy of science. So this book really, really changed my view towards humanities, and I'm sure our listeners will enjoy, if they've enjoyed this great podcast. I've personally immensely enjoyed this conversation. I'm sure they'll enjoy reading the book. And maybe you also want to, before I say goodbye, you want also to introduce the latest book you worked on. And I have secured a promise from you to get in touch with you soon to talk about that book in New Books Network as well. So maybe briefly just want to name that book, because it's a sort of a sequel to this book that you've written.
Yeah, so the latest book that I published just earlier this year, last year, 2022, with Johns Hopkins University Press, is called World of Patterns, A Global History of Knowledge, where I actually want to extend my field of historical research, not just to the humanistic disciplines, but also to the social and especially the natural science disciplines, but also including fields like medicine and even legal studies, where you can also find the search for patterns and principles. And but I must stress also that after I finished that book, I said I felt into a deep hole. You could say. I said, well, what now? I now approach the history of knowledge. So recently, I'm now working on finalizing a book on trying to, again, using still the approach of searching for patterns and principles. But right now, I'm finalizing it just these months. I'm working on a global history of giving sense to life. There's a beautiful word for it in Dutch and German and other Germanic languages. It says Sinngebung. There's just one word, which means giving sense, making sense of life. And also there, we can again compare all different countries, all different cultures in the world, how people, not just by means of religion, they're even using scientific approaches, even using searching for beauty, searching for justice. But how do people in different parts of the world search for meaning, so to say? That's the next step. Just talking about ridiculous megalomaniac ideas, I fully agree that this is perhaps too broad a field, but so we have to try it. I think we need to try
two more podcasts with you soon this year, hopefully. Professor Rens Bond, thank you very much for your time and for talking with us on New Books Network.
It was my pleasure.